for the first talk of the year, the new year, 2019. If I hadn't said Happy New Year resoundingly. You're welcome to come to the Open Forum any Wednesday night of the year. It's here. This is not a meeting of the Humanist Society of New South Wales. The Society owns the building and gives us house room every Wednesday. We are the Open Forum, and we've met here for 47 years, non-stop. Could be 48 now, I've lost count. A speaker, is a good speaker on a topical and controversial subject as well, is guaranteed every Wednesday. Excuse me, I don't want to... That's safer. Now, tonight's topic is the law as therapy, which I don't think is a topic we've had before. We've had lawyers here, but we've had therapists, but we've never had the law as therapy. David Murphy, David Murphy is the founding president of the Self Litigants Association. He has spoken here before on a different topic. This will be his second talk. He's founding president of the Self Litigants Association, which aims to give people the option of defending their own cases in court without the you-know-what costs, which can be ruinous. So I'd like you to welcome Mr. David Murphy, the Law as Therapy. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for coming along tonight. Tonight's topic is Law as Therapy, or Law Therapy, as we call it. Law is therapeutic and can be a healing process if you know how to do it. Law can be, we have a saying, smart victims get paid, winning is the best therapy, and it can be a process and it applies best in civil, but it can be done in criminal as well too. So, a little bit about my background. I got involved in the legal arena at the age of, 10, when I filed in the Supreme Court at the age of 10, against Strathfield Council for an accident that I happened on council land when I was 9 years old, when Strathfield Council had allowed Bressington Park to turn into a garbage tip, a gazetted park, and chemical companies were dumping chemicals in the park, and little boys were going to the park and falling in and getting burnt. So I got burnt at the age of 9 in Bressington Park, and we decided to sue Strathfield Council. And after 2 years, Strathfield Council decided that they wouldn't contest the matter, they would settle out of court. So, at the age of 12, I entered into a terms of settlement on terms not to be disclosed. That terms not to be disclosed was something which was to have an effect many, many years later. There was no reason for there to be terms not to be disclosed, but the terms of settlement was terms not to be disclosed. I've since had a release from Strathfield Council and can talk about it, but terms not to be disclosed means you can't talk about it for the rest of your life or disclose the terms, or you have to pay the money back. So, and they take that, there are some people that take that fairly seriously too. So, the amount of the claim originally was £15,000. We settled for $9,000 in 1966 with $500 costs. Now, things went along quietly from then on. The money went to the public trustee. Money was paid into the Supreme Court. Supreme Court paid it to the public trustee, and I became an investor by an order of the Supreme Court on the 8th of June 1966, by an order of the Supreme Court as an investor. And I stayed an investor in that matter because that matter continued on. Because what happened 24 years later is I got approached by a finance professional to evidence and engineer a breach of the terms of settlement. And apparently this goes on, that you can be approached 24 years later, many years later, to breach the terms, and then the process commences of recovering the money and taking your assets and so on, because you entered into a terms of settlement in a court case 24 years later before. And people don't put two and two together and to work it out. Took me a while to work it out. But anyway, the people who, the underlings, the operatives, who came along to collect back the $9,500 as an investment loan to them, which was subsequently caught by the Credit Administration Act of 1984 and would have been a fraud, but for something that happened. They knew that I could not breach. They knew that I didn't know the terms, because when I was 24 years later, I did not remember what the gross settlement amount was, and they knew that I could not breach, but their job was to evidence and engineer a breach of the terms of settlement, which they did, and collected a check, a cash check of $9,500. So that was my introduction into the active legal arena in 1990. And
Well, you
have to pay it back. Yeah, you've got to pay it back. You're subject to recovery if you breach the terms.
You were able to pay it back.
What?
You were able to pay it back.
Well, they collected the money as an investment that was caught by the Credit Act. So they did evidence and engineer a breach of the terms. Yeah. The interesting thing was that the breach of the terms that they evidenced and engineered wasn't by me.
The money was there to claim back. Yeah.
Let me get this clear. They set you up.
They set you up. This goes on. Yeah. Apparently this goes on, and people don't realise this sort of thing goes on. And it happened to me.
Just got a clarity.
Yeah.
But the breach wasn't by me.
No.
The finance professional nominated the amount, and he had disclosed to him the term not to be disclosed, being the amount.
Yeah.
So he breached, which means his client who instructed him breached. So the strong thing is, I didn't breach, and this created a legal phenomenon yet to develop. So, because I wasn't the one to breach, and since their job was to recover the money as a whole range of investment loans to the clients of the accountant, they offered me a deed of engagement and provision, which was a very strange arrangement with a chap called Jim Burns, James Warren Burns, you may have heard of him. He acted for Alan Bond many years ago in Bond's bankruptcy, and Jim Burns does these weird financial deals and things like that, and is a bit of a character around town, or used to be, to do things. So they offered me this deed of engagement and provision with a provision for all monies outstanding at an interest rate of 40% per annum, compounding at quarterly rests, and that's been compounding for the past 28 years. 40% is what was offered in the deed. Now there are loans around that payday loans lenders do at 40% and so on like that. So it is a rate that is around the place. But they offered it to me at 40%. And the curious thing is, on the day of the deed, AGC went guarantor for the all monies outstanding and all the provisions of the deed. So I have a guarantor, and that's risen up now to Westpac and is shared by Westpac and GE. Because GE bought AGC off Westpac and they didn't sort out the guarantee. So it's just continued to grow. I thought it was going to become a court case, but along the way, I learnt a number of legal processes.
What happened to the council?
Well, the council didn't know what had happened after they gave the job over to the GIO. And the GIO did a settlement of a 7931, which was a special settlement that's an evidence to the court that it's subject to recovery in future years. You have to have that figure for something to happen later on. So I learnt a number of processes along the way in trying to pursue these cases. And so we'll go into a couple of those processes. AGC went guarantor, but I didn't know they were the guarantor at the time until I found my file back from Supreme Court archives in 1999 and started to put the whole picture together that the approach in 1990 was connected to my childhood settlement in 1966, and the whole picture started to come together that apparently this goes on, that you get approached to breach your terms. If you breach the terms, you're subject to recovery. But since I didn't breach, they gave me this deed with a provision of monies outstanding. And computers had been invented at the time, and spreadsheets had been invented at the time, so it was possible to keep the accounts. Whereas in times past, it wouldn't have been possible for people to keep the accounts. So I've kept the accounts of how it grows. I thought it was going to go to court, and I learnt a number of processes that you won't learn from the solicitors and so on. I'm going to share three of those with you tonight. Three particular processes I've learnt as a litigant in person and as a law therapist, as I call it, because law can be therapeutic if you know these processes, because there's healing in the power of the law if you've been the victim of a scam or a fraud or something like that, and you know these processes and you know how to correspond and how to do things. An email is a wonderful tool in this. You just need an email address, you need to write it up, and then you send it off. So AGC went guarantor. I didn't know that. I sued AGC. There was a judgment, and just last year AGC lost that case from 1995. So let's go into a few of the techniques of law therapy. One of the techniques that I learnt along the way is one which can speed up a court matter. Is there anyone here involved in any legal matters at the moment? No? I would recommend you stay out of it. Don't get involved. But if you are, be a plaintiff. Don't be a defendant, be a plaintiff. If you can, do it. And do it all in writing. Don't get into verbal, because you're probably not an expert in the court to do that. You just do it in writing, and you hand it up to the judge and say, seek leave to submit my submissions in writing, and you don't say anything much more. And I won a matter in equity in 2016 against the state government doing just that. Caught them off guard, and they breached. They defaulted in a matter. So let's look at a few of the law therapy techniques for law as therapy. The first one is the court encourages people to settle before going to court, to discuss and work out their issues and define them and refine them and work out just exactly what the issues are rather than waffle on in court and so on. So there's a process under section 17.3 of the Uniform Civil Procedure Rules called Notice to Admit Facts and Admit Authenticity of Documents. And that process is designed for people to put a number of requests to admit to the other side, and the law says that if the other side doesn't respond within 14 days and deal with them, it's all admitted in your favour, and then you are entitled to a section 17.7 judgment on admissions. Now what lawyers like to do is they like to go to court, put on their evidence, put on their submissions, do a performance, bring in a barrister, increase costs and it gets expensive, and you have a feeling of illusion while you're using a lawyer. You don't know which way it's going to go, and you don't know what the lawyers are going to discuss themselves. Oh, you can win this one, I'll win the one next week. You don't know what deals they're doing between themselves. You don't know. So it can be an illusion. Yes?
Sorry to ask, but the Office of Fair Trade, you're talking about things that can't be settled if you're dealing with a business or a company. What sort of cases?
Would be civil, would be contract or tort, and notice to admit facts can be done in the federal court and in the family court as well too, as the civil courts, local, district and supreme court and high court. So you can use notice to admit facts in a number of jurisdictions, and it speeds things up because it gets all these admissions locked in, and if they don't answer within 14 days in any of those jurisdictions, it resolves in your favour as the requesting party because the other side hasn't responded. It's a wonderful thing, and you don't get lawyers using it because they don't earn much out of it because it speeds up the process too much. So I'll give you an example of the wording of this. I brought a long one, which I did on Westpac, and I did a number of requests to admit facts on Westpac about 2 years ago in 2016. To get everything locked in and all organised, because I knew my matter back the front. And if you know your matter back the front, it's fairly easy to do these. The way you phrase the notice to admit facts is you would start off, the plaintiff requires you to admit the following facts. Now, if they admit all these, you're home and hosed. You don't have to go through the whole performance and everything and the stress of using a lawyer and all that sort of thing. So do you admit or agree that it is the case, is it not, that as claimed the following facts are so, blah, 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 and you lay it all out and you send it off by email, or you can do it by letter or something, or you take it in. I do it by email, so I've got a record of it on the computer because I like to have all my material on the computer, know when it was sent and have records at my fingertips. And if they don't answer within 14 days, I'll read you out what it says from the legislation. For notice to admit facts. Uniform Civil Procedure Rules 2005 in the Federal Court, this is Rule 2001. In the Family Court, I can't remember what number it is, but it's all similar stuff. Notice to admit facts. The requesting party may, by a notice served on the admitting party, the requesting party's notice, require the admitting party to admit, for the purpose of the proceedings only, the facts specified in the notice. This is the important paragraph. If as to any facts specified in the requesting party's notice, the admitting party does not, within 14 days after service on the admitting party of the requesting party's notice, serve on the requesting party a notice disputing that fact is, for the purposes of the proceedings only, taken to have been admitted by the admitting party in favour of the requesting party only. So this can be two ways to win a case. One is, as I said, put on your evidence and prove it on the balance of probabilities. If it's in the criminal arena, on beyond reasonable doubt. So, in the civil arena, on the balance of probabilities, you argue the case and do all of that sort of thing. The quick way is just get them to admit everything. This is the system to get them to admit everything. If they don't answer within 14 days, because they think, oh, we'll do it in court or something, it's too late. It's all over. So, you do the process before going to court, and just to be safe, if you go to court, you file a statement of claim, you hit them with this the second time around, and so they admit twice. A good process after the 14 days are over is you send a copy of their admissions for confirmation, and you elaborate on the admissions and give more detail, and go into more detail of what you would like to get into admission. And you send them that confirmation of admissions, and you give them another 14 days. And then the second lot of 14 days, and everything is confirmed. It's very strong when it goes to court, because the judge can't go against it, because it's the law of the land. But I'll read paragraph 3. This is an important one, because they look at paragraph 3, and they think, oh, we don't have to answer anything. The admitting party may, with the leave of the court, withdraw any such admission. Now they look at that and think, oh, if we don't answer it and we admit it, we can pull it back later on. But the court doesn't give that just for the asking. You've got to have really good reasons. And the only precedent in the High Court is if you use the solicitor and the solicitor is one day late over the 14 days, you can get a 15th day. They can get a 15th day. So notice to admit facts is a very powerful tool for the litigant in person who wants to speed up matters and get all their facts locked in and have a lot more feeling of confidence in their matter, because that law, the other side, has admitted everything. And so they've got nowhere to go. What I do after the confirmation step, the second lot of 14 days, is you give them 28 days to exercise their Section 3 right to have the matter before the court. At this stage, you haven't filed in the court even. You're doing this before going to court. And they've got to file to go to court to get it set aside. And if they don't answer within 28 days, they basically shot themselves to pieces. So that's a good process, notice to admit facts. Anybody heard of that one before? Anybody used it before?
Happily not.
It's a good process.
What if they look at the thing, and well, there's a couple of things. What if they say, oh, the person it was sent to is not the one to be making the actual...
Oh, it's got to be the right person. You've got to go to the
somehow,
right person. It's going to be the plaintiff.
And what happens if they actually answer, no, this is a load of malarkey, this is a load of malarkey?
Okay. We have a little section after each paragraph, because we ask them some questions. After each paragraph, there's B, C, D, and E. So you ask them these, and it's easy to copy and paste these on your computer and put them all in. So after each paragraph, you ask them what you want to put on and the particular facts and so on to which you're referring. And then 1B, if you do not admit or agree, then why do you not admit or agree? 1C, if you say the facts are not so, then why are they not so? 1D, if you say the facts are not so, then how are they not so? That'll confuse them. Mm-hmm. 1E, who told you this and what was their experience? So you ask them that one after each one, and they just throw their hands up and say, this is too hard. We'll try something, we'll. But if they don't answer it, it's admitted by law under the rules of the court. It's all fairly straightforward, and you can just read that in section 17.3, and it's in the federal court and the family court. And it's probably not used as much as it could be. Any particular questions on notice to admit facts and authenticity?
Yes, well, what organisation or what person would you use this against?
Any defendant. You've got a defendant in a matter where you want to speed things up and get all the facts locked in and not waffle on, and the whole thing goes on for ages, for weeks, months or years.
No, I mean, if you were to take the counsel to court.
Yeah, you could do it if you've got a...
Would this be a valid point?
Yes.
A valid solution?
You can use it against an individual or a corporation or a government body, if as long as it's a civil matter, federal matter, family matter, and notice to admit facts applies in that jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. You can do it.
Do you think it might be a good thing to do the bulk of your talk and then take questions? That's the way we normally do it.
David, I think that would be overwhelming at the end.
It's the way we do it. So if you want to take notes, take notes.
We may have to leave.
think he prefers
to. He's a point-to-point man.
Yeah, he may be a point-to-point man, but it's better if you give us your picture and then we can respond to it.
Yes.
If someone makes a mistake in what they're writing down.
Who? The plaintiff or the defendant? The one asking or the one?
The one asking. What if they...
Oh, you've got to check it very carefully.
Yeah.
You've got to check it very carefully.
Yeah.
Because you'll be bound by what you wrote. Because it's...
Oh, all right, okay.
Sort of irrevocable. You've got to be very careful in what you write, and you've got to know your matter, and you've got to know where you're going, where you want to go. You've got to have a strategy and a game plan and all of that as where you want to end up, and so on. So you lock that all in and lay it all out as you go through
but
the various...
If they wrote something that wasn't right, what happens with the person who's making the...
Well, you are going to be caught,
don't you? Response?
The one who's making the...
Well, they've got to make sure... They're asking the right question. They've got to think about it. Maybe they should talk to some friends or somebody like that.
But someone could accuse somebody of something that they haven't done.
It's not an accusation. That would be criminal. So it's requesting an admission or an agreement. But if they haven't done it, and it's basically can be argued later on that they were on the other side of the world at the time or something, they could get up on that. But they should take notice of it and try and answer.
You have a fair bit to say for them to digest, so I think
yes.
you have a lot more to say.
Yes, so I'm going on.
I think it might be
the...
a good thing to listen to David Murphy before you just hoe in.
So I'll go on to the second process that I have learned along the way, and this was a real beauty because I obtained a precedent in the Supreme Court in Equity before Justice Lindsay on the 15th of December 2015, in which I had championed an argument called a contractual civil bet. Now, a contractual civil bet is something that you've probably never heard of as a legal term before or a legal process. You won't get it from a lawyer, and it was a process that appeared in 2014 when I had a dispute with a government department and they alleged something in particular. And I thought, well, the way to deal with this is we just do a bet on the subject. We take up a civil bet. Now, from my reserve, from my major case, it had grown to a very large amount of money. So I thought, these idiots aren't going to argue against it. I'm going to pit a very large amount of money in the civil bet. And you know what the idiots did? They took it up. They committed an act of adoption of the civil bet on the evening of 14th of March 2014, and I thought, well, they've taken it up, so I've got to eventually go on to collect at one point. So I had reason to do an action in the Equity Division of the Supreme Court, so I pleaded this contractual civil bet, and Justice Lindsay made a decision. You'll love this. You will love this. You will have never heard of anything like this. He said I lost the civil bet. And I thought, oh, if I lost the civil bet, what does that mean? Can you tell me what that means? I lost the contractual civil bet for this very large amount of money.
You've got to pay?
No, I lost the bet.
Does the bet mean you gambled?
It's a form of a gamble, but it's not a gamble which cannot be proceeded within the courts.
Yeah.
The courts do not support the idea of a gamble or a bet where there is uncertainty, improbability and chance, because that's not the elements of contract. But a contractual civil bet is based on evidence, admissions, argument and so on, the elements of contract. So it will stand up in the court. So the judge found not that it was void, but that I lost.
But the bet means a gamble though, doesn't it?
Well, the court assumes you know the law.
Yeah, well,
and as a party, you're supposed to know your case. You're supposed to know whether you're going to win or lose before you even start, the court assumes.
No, I purely asked you what that word BET meant in a legal context, which I...
Which one?
Bet, B-E-T, bet.
Bet.
Yeah. What does that mean?
It was a bet.
In a legal context.
Well, usually it's a chance thing.
Yeah.
But this is the same procedure because I know my case and I'm going to prove the whole thing.
Yeah.
So he found that I had lost the civil bet.
Yeah.
Now that had two meanings. One, the civil bet was in force.
Yeah.
So he found that it was actually in existence. It had been taken up, civil bet was in force, I lost, which meant there were eight winners. Because if I lost the civil bet, there's a winner. And in this case, there were eight of them, and you guess who one of them was? The judge.
Yeah.
Really?
And the other one, another one, was the chief witness, because they all alleged something, and they all won because the judge wrote a judgment that they'd all win. So they all won. So I thought, well, these people better pursue their money. So we had a hearing date on the 10th of February 2016, and I wrote to all the winners and said, come to court and pursue your win or forever abandon it, and it comes back to me. And then none of them turned up. Mm-hmm. So the state of New South Wales put on a legal argument to try and get themselves out of this situation, is that I didn't have mental capacity when I created the civil bet, that I had a mental illness. So I didn't have mental capacity to enter into the civil bet. Now, since I'm the one who created the concept of the civil bet and championed it, and they took it up, and I argued for it, and my affidavit wasn't questioned, etc., I said to the state of New South Wales, if I didn't have mental capacity and I lost this large amount of money because I entered into this civil bet and I lost the money according to judgment, I'm entitled to a refund. So I want it back, and I give you 14 days or you default. And they defaulted, and that set up another fund which has been growing. So the contractual civil bet is a step that you can do. An example would be, somebody says, you're an idiot, you've got a mental illness. So what's your answer to that? What would you say? Want a bet? Your house, all your investment properties, let's bet.
Where's your evidence?
And if they shake hands, you just say, I won. I just got all your properties and proved I don't have a mental illness, because the steps of being mentally sane are making money, acquiring assets, being happy, following due process, being organised, setting an example, taking charge, and helping others. The 8 steps of good mental health. So, in winning and so on, you have a bet and you win their properties and you prove you don't have a mental illness. Because the whole mental illness thing is all based on a breach of the Mental Health Act, where they're not providing the treatment alternatives, they're just promoting medication. So there's breach in the system. So you have the strength of doing it, and there's strength in doing these processes. Any questions about contractual civil bets?
Yes. If you gave example, not necessarily what it was in your case, but very similar, so we can see in detail how did it start? What was the issue?
You were not here.
Give me an example of something you may have a contention on somebody with.
Well, it's about mental illness. I mean, they need an expert in there to be able to say whether you have a mental illness or not. They can't just go and say you have a mental illness. They've got to have some kind of expert.
I know of a case where there have been 9 psychiatrists in a row that have alleged a mental illness.
Oh, well, that's different. You've got psychiatrists.
Those 5 of those have admitted under Section 17.3 that the person doesn't have a mental illness.
Yeah.
So they've said one thing, and since the person won the civil bet, the person has proved they don't.
Yeah.
And so it proves 9 psychiatrists in a row cannot diagnose.
That's pretty high.
Which is a very good case that shows psychiatrists cannot diagnose.
Yeah.
And but medical practitioners can only give opinion.
Yes.
Well, they give a diagnosis. But I'm talking about mental health. I'm not talking about physical health. Mm-hmm. That's a whole different area. Any other questions about contractual civil bets? You want to look for an opportunity to have one. They're good fun. But to do a contractual civil bet, you have got to have capacity to do it. There's the elements of contract: offer, acceptance, capacity, consideration, and one of those is capacity, and one is financial capacity. That to enter into a contractual civil bet, you've got to be able to ante up, just like at a game of poker or something. You've got to be able to ante up and have the money available, and you can do it. And it happened that from my major legal case, I could do this. And do you want to know what that amount was? The $140,000 had grown at 40% per annum compounding for many, many years. And about a week or two or three before I upped the ante from 500 million, I upped it to 2 billion. So it was a bet of 2 billion, and the idiots let me win. And that created a reserve 10. I love this stuff. I've got a reserve with the state of New South Wales, and I'm having an interesting time doing these sort of things.
So can you actually draw that money from them or draw anything
from them? With State of New South Wales, I can't withdraw it, but I can do set off. I can do recovery by way of set off. And
like if you get a lot of parking fines, you can say, all right.
Well, I'm having fun at the moment in the courts doing that sort of stuff over little amounts. And I'm putting this on because if they lose and they admit to all that, they admit the whole thing. So I'm having an interesting time. But I've got them over a barrel and I know the legislation and I'm winning on these cases. So I'm having an amusing time. But if they admit and lose, it means the whole amount is admitted at law. And I lock in the whole amount of the large amount.
Can they declare you as vexatious and dismissed?
No, I've got a cause of action.
Yeah.
And anyway, I'm not leading the action. I'm a defendant in those matters. I'm a defendant. Now, a number of properties came up at Miller's Point. And so I did something in regard to those properties that were coming up through, I think it was FACS, F-A-C-S, or whoever was selling off properties. And these were put to me. So I just did the set-offs from the account and did the payment to the mortgage transfer fee, the stamp duty, and the price of the property from the state government, and title passed the day or two before the auction, and I put in the letter to the solicitor that I'd like them to find somebody who can do the renovations for me. So the next day they ran these mock auctions and got people in who thought they'd bought the place and are renovating them. So I'm just sitting back until it's all done.
Really?
So you can have interesting times being a litigant in person when you know these processes. Smart victims get paid. Winning is the best therapy. There is strength in being a victim. There are good sayings when you know these processes. We'll move on to the last technique. The technique is a thing called a lien. A lien. L-I-E-N. A lien. You've probably heard of a possessory lien. A lien over a piece of equipment. And a finance company takes a lien over the asset and lends out money, or it's a possessory lien. Common law, possessory lien. This is not one of this. This is the equity version, the general equitable lien, which means you don't have to have possession of it. And you can take a general equitable lien. And there are types of general equitable liens. There is a determinable, evaluative, presumptive general equitable lien. And this is a way of getting paid a debt if somebody owes you some money. A lot of people have somebody who owes them some money.
Mm.
Normally you're told, write a letter of demand. And you write a letter of demand and you say, if you do not pay within 28 days, I shall commence legal proceedings to recover the matter in court. That's one way to do it that the lawyers like. And in small claims, you can't use lawyers and you can't claim legal fees. Well, you can use a lawyer, but you've got to pay your own legal fees. In general division, you can claim for legal fees. In small claims, you can't do notice to admit facts, but in general division, you can.
So what is a small claim?
Small claim is $10,000 or less.
Oh, okay.
In the local court, because somebody owes you some money. Okay. But the first step you do is you write a letter. So this sort of fleshes it out for the court, gives an explanation. So you don't launch into it and then try and do verbal explanations. You write a detailed letter and lay it all out and see what they do. But another way you can do it is you do the lien, and you do the general equitable lien. And you say, at the moment, you owe me $8,000 on for these reasons, etc., etc., and I would like for you to pay me back the $8,000. Now, if you do not pay me back the $8,000, what I shall do is after 14 days, if you do not, I shall take a determinable, evaluative, general equitable lien over your assets and give you another 14 days to pay. So I will take a security, take a lien over those assets at law, and you have 14 days to pay. If you do not pay in the second lot of 14 days, I will foreclose at law and activate that lien and then become the owner of those assets at law and start charging you rent. So a letter like that really gives them a shock, and you can have the effect of getting paid. It can be better than the general letter of demand, because this one is a shocker that you're going to take a presumptive, evaluative, determinable, equitable lien. It is determined. Yes?
What did they simply tell you to do now?
Well, you can go to court and do the whole thing there. They may do that. They may have nothing. The thing is, it is evaluative. It evaluates their assets to the value of the debt. Now, if they don't have anything, they don't care. But if they have properties and things like that, and they're surrendering it all for $8,000 and giving it to you, it's a donation. So you can do a claim. You can pursue the lien in court and see what happens. I would love to do some cases like that and see what happens.
No, I mean, if they say, look, your claim for the $8,000 is without merit.
Oh, if they say there's no basis, you've got to know you're right.
Yeah.
It can't be speculative. You've got to have good reason to do it. You've got to know that they do actually owe you the money.
Right.
You do have a basis in fact and law.
Yeah.
You've got to know your stuff. You can't do this and win if really fundamentally you're wrong. So you've got to be correct. You've got to know your material. So the lien is determinable in that you can determine it after 14 days. It only exists for 14 days because then it becomes determined. It can be evaluative because it evaluates their assets worldwide, whatever they are, if any, to the value of the debt. And it's presumptive and it presumes that they don't owe anything or they're not going to do anything or whatever. So that's a process which you can do to settle a debt as a litigant in person. An interesting one. It doesn't stop you then going to court and doing notice, statement of claim and things like that, but you can plead that in there that you've done this and see what the magistrate or judge makes of it. But it may be an equitable step, not common law. Any questions? We'll take questions now.
So that's probably good for a fairly small claim.
That's, you can use it for any size claim. If the claim is for $50 million and they only own a house,
well, yeah,
it backfires. So, but most wouldn't be like that.
I could think of another way in which it could backfire. And that is, I was thinking particularly of the sort of thing that happened in the middle of the GFC. You could write a letter back saying, I hereby donate to you my entire assets, which are negative $10 billion.
I don't think you can value them at negative $10 billion. That means that they are mortgaged to somebody else. And
yeah. It means I owe more than I've got.
Because you've got mortgages.
Well, yeah, or because they're tied up in instruments whose current value is negative.
In debt.
Yeah.
In debt. A general equitable lien can have priority over a mortgage or a caveat. So that means you can take the house, the property, if it's a large enough debt, and they get to keep the mortgage.
Oh, right.
They don't like that one.
No, you're taking questions, are you?
Questions now,
okay,
yes.
Okay, well, in that case, just sit down for a minute, because I want to make an announcement. Because that's what I do halfway through. I make an announcement. And thank you for your...
Before we go into questions, I'll just make a bit of an announcement. This fund that has grown over the years is something which I watched growing over the years, thinking, what the heck am I going to do with this, in principle, this amount that has grown under the deed of engagement and provision to which AGC went guarantor and Westpac is parent guarantor, whether they like it or not. And what am I going to do with this fund on paper? And I thought, I'm not a great materialist. I'm not very good at materialism. I can use it to pay a debt, because it's my money. No problems there. I can use it to pay a debt. But the debt doesn't have to be mine. I can use it to pay other people's debts, if other people have got debt situations. I can use it to pay other people's debts. So for the past quite a few months, a year maybe more now, people have been coming forward, appearing, who've got debt situations. We've been getting these very interesting debt situations. So the money wasn't a gift to them, and they don't have to repay the amount. It's not a loan. It was regarded as a grant on non-financial terms. But what these financial terms were was very iffy, because I couldn't really work out. One lady does my cleaning, and we did a hex debt with the Department of Taxation with her, and we wiped out a $12,000 hex debt and got an interim receipt from the Reserve Bank for the payment. And that's been a very interesting precedent. So we've got a few of these. But it's not a grant, it's not a gift, it's a grant, but it was on non-financial terms. So I've formalised it a bit and made it a process that people can share in now. And as of the 1st of January, the situation is, if people have got a debt, like one lady I met, just about in the last week had a mortgage of $500,000. The deal is they pay me 10% or $50,000 and I start the process to wipe the entire debt by wiping it off out of the reserve by paying the creditor $500,000 out of the reserve as a equitable entitlement that grows under the deed terms of 40% per annum, so it's very negotiable, and the spotter gets 10% of the 10%. So I make that offer to all of you, and I've got a brochure here on it, which I'll give out, so that you can think about it. My number is in there if you want to be a litigant in person or anything. And we'll take questions. So any further questions?
Would you be able to... Would you be able to teach someone how to do that? And
well, I've recorded tonight, so I can send you a link for it if you want to re-listen to it again. Would you like to do that? Because I've gone through three techniques tonight.
I mean, would you be able to teach someone together so that...
You're a litigant in person, I'll sit down with you, have a coffee and give you some help. But that's a service to the court.
What's in that
for
you?
Well, I just like to. I'm an ex-teacher. I'm an ex-teacher. Once a teacher, always a teacher. Well, I teach it. Oh, it's a cup of coffee. It's socialising and teaching people about the law, which they're entitled to know about. They should know their facts. The court assumes you know the law.
Selling yourself cheap.
So
I'll have one of those too. Thanks.
Yes.
Thanks.
So, if people have got some albatross type of debt, if somebody's headed for bankruptcy, we can annul a bankruptcy also with this process, by the way, if you know somebody would like their bankruptcy annulled, because when the money is transferred, if the creditor refuses the money and says, I'm not going to accept this, under the law it annuls the debt, as far as the debtor is concerned, because the creditor only gets one bite of the cherry to be paid. If they refuse the being paid, knock it back, the court throws them out. They don't help them if they knocked it back the first time. So, we can help people with difficult, awful debts. But there can be an ordeal that happens that they're not used to, because they will experience the biggest bluff of their life from the banks. They will go through an ordeal and that the banks will bluff because they don't want to lose a case like this. And I've got some of those cases. And since I've been involved in legal matters for 28 years, I know I'm going to win, because I'm not the one who breached the terms, I'm not the one who breached the deed, and AGC went guarantor. So, yes?
You know which case I'm talking about.
Yes, I know the one.
You know exactly.
And I've got the evidence for it.
Yeah.
I've got the evidence for that.
As you know, said case, they are demanding a rather large sum of money.
Well, once that evidence goes in, well, should it be?
Can, let's say that was paid, that rather large sum of money, because they were trying to basically bankrupt
the said
pay person.
But that's an admission.
Yep. So they're trying to bankrupt him. Could the notice to admit facts be used against them
at any stage?
In a new case?
Even in the old case, because it's already been filed. Notice to admit
facts. It's gone through appeal and appeal and appeal. And
I know, but notice to admit facts can be done. Because suddenly they can go through appeal and do all of that and exhaust all of that, and they've won, and you shoot off this notice to admit facts, and suddenly they've admitted everything under the law. And suddenly the guy wins.
So we'll have to take you over to you-know-who in hospital at some stage.
I'm ready to do that process. I've done a preparation for a book on global warming, the New South Wales experience, global warming with a question mark, to find out, based on the past 120 years of observations in New South Wales from 88 observation sites, what is actually going on in global warming. And I've developed 88 graphs and some composite graphs, and I've come to the conclusions that I'm ready to go to court to win these cases on global warming. So I'm looking forward to those cases.
I'm intimately involved with.
Yes, well, this evidence will shoot it to pieces, because it shows in his area, Cooma, the temperature has been dropping for 120 years, maximum and minimum. And so he gets an exemption. He can get an exemption, and he can apply for the first exemption.
It's Cooma up in the mountains. Is it high?
Yes, Cooma.
So it's high up, isn't it?
Yes, but the temperature, long term, we do an average, we do a moving average 11 years on the sunspot cycles, and we do a running average over 11 years for 120 years, we do run on the maximum.
You can dictate what happens to the whole world.
I want other people in other states to follow suit and do the same book for their states on their different states' experience, and then worldwide, and this will be the evidence that can't, incontrovertible evidence to shoot down global warming.
By the way, David has a case regarding global warming ever been fought?
I don't know the global warming
in an Australian court.
I don't know, but I'm looking forward to the first one.
Okay, it'll be the first one.
I'm looking forward, and then we'll get
railroaded. I agree with the idea.
I'll be very interested to see you. Hear you in court. It'll be fascinating.
Well, it'll be done in writing. You just hand it up and say.
I'll be fascinated. I mean, you're entitled to change.
Okay.
Now, somebody said on the radio today, Pauline Hanson is one of the big naysayers. She's anti-global warming and all of that. And I thought, oh, I'll send it off to her and ask her for some referrals. So maybe she'll know some people who've got some potential global warming cases because they're being trumped up with all of this stuff over global warming. So I'll supply the evidence for their immediate area. Because I can do anyone in Australia.
Excuse me, Brian, you've had the baker's dozen.
Sorry, Ben, this is interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll find it fascinating. Yeah. The central issue is not whether there's global warming, but whether it's man-made.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
That is the central issue. Whether it's global,
whether it is
man-made, that is the central issue.
Well, I'll tell you the observations I've found, some conclusions I've found, why the readings on global warming are going up, and that's two of them, because many of the observations are taken in areas where the urbanisation and building is becoming more and more concentrated. Those buildings during the day heat up and retain their heat, so the maximums don't go up as much as the minimums go up in the charts. The minimums increase more because the buildings, the cement, the roads retain the heat, and so you get this latent temperature going up and showing up in the minimum temperatures. The other one is that a number of the observation sites are at airports, and the tarmacs heat up and retain the heat, and so you get a hotter temperature, and so the temperatures go up. So it's a bit artificial in the readings, and that's what seems to be coming.
I think you have a question, Mishka, do you?
Still on the same issue, it's global, it's not warming, but climate change, so...
It's always been happening.
Which means nothing. But it's a meaningless term.
I think the summers, or where it's hot, is getting hotter, and the cold month is getting even colder.
There's a kind of divergence.
Whether it's catastrophic, I don't know, but possibly. So this, what you are checking, it doesn't apply to that kind of...
We see areas where it's going down, areas where it's going up.
No, in the same area, the month hot become hotter and the colder month become more cold than in the past.
I do a median temperature for the entire year.
Well, then you abolish the phenomenon, kind of.
Yes, Nick?
Yes, I just wanted to tie up to what she's saying and what you're saying. I study meteorology on my own, just to, my own little things, and I want to agree with you exactly for what you have said. I have observed throughout the past year that most of the sites of New South Wales have measured temperature. The monthly maximum and the monthly minimum has been slightly lower than the average, except for two sites, which is the Sydney Observatory Hill and one is at the airport.
Observatory Hill is going up very nicely all the way.
Yes.
Because Sydney is such a heat sink.
That's right. And the airport is always higher, even the minimums and the maximums. For every one of the months, they always are higher than the average. But every other site has below the average for that particular site.
Yes, the heat sinks are going up. Because of all the buildings and things like that. Now, I'll give you the conclusion that can be drawn. Global warming is definitely happening, I can tell you that. And the conclusion will be, over the next 1,000 years, global warming temperatures will increase by 3 degrees. And you think, gee, it goes up by more than that every day. 3 degrees over 1,000 years, so what? and then it may all go the other way.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably heading that way. I mean, if you look at the charts, actually, it is about to have a dip.
I'm thinking it's going to be three years of dip.
In fact, it has been dipping, but they sort of lie about and fudge about it. The thing is, in the late 70s, well, actually, it was the early 70s, they're all flapping and thinking, oh, we're going to have another ice age. And then suddenly, oh, it became catastrophic global warming. But, well, one day I'll give a talk on that here. To predicate having all this climate action, you have to, not only does it have to be, the rate of warming have to be unprecedented, but it also has to be man-made from that 3 to 50% of CO2 increases of human origin, and it must be dangerous. In the Cook et al. Study in 2013, where they reviewed 11,944 abstracts, only 41 papers actually said that human activity is the dominant cause of global warming slash climate change, but not a single one of those papers, zero of those papers said that it was dangerous. So out of 11,944 papers, there is not a single paper, that, and this is over 21 years that they reviewed these papers, that said that it was man-made and dangerous, which of course the essential things to have all this climate action. The whole thing is a hoax based on not a single shred of evidence.
But now we've got evidence to the contrary.
How can we put that into court?
Now we've got the evidence to the contrary, and you take a civil bet. You take a civil bet.
But they fudge the numbers, they lie.
No, but I've got the evidence from the Bureau of Meteorology.
But they'll say, oh, that's just Cooma.
I've got 88 of them. Well, I can do any one in Australia. I can do them and bring
now,
them up from the area.
Now, David,
we have some context, Fred
wants to ask you a question.
Yes.
Go on, Fred.
What you handed out, it looks a bit very much like a pyramid-type scheme.
There's no selling.
The way you word it, you're asking people to refer other debtors who pay their 10%, etc.
Yeah, there's a spotter's fee, 10% of 10%.
Right.
There's a spotter's fee.
That sounds very much like a pyramid scheme.
No, pyramid is where you've got multi-level and they're buying in and buying stock and all of that. That's a referral system.
Okay, I would like to remind everybody that this is a talk on law, not a talk on science or global warming. And you've drifted so far off the edge of the world that I think we have to bring you back. That what David is talking about is law as he has experienced it. And as he believes it can be practiced.
If you're ultimately in the right in your matter, and you know how to do it, and you've got to know how to do it, or you can get into a real mess. But if you're ultimately in the right, you can work your way through to the win, and it's relaxing and therapeutic. Yes.
How many?
You may actually have answered what I was about to ask you just then, but I really wanted to invite you to summarise the legal and personal bottom line to everything you've been saying.
It's a journey. Each case is a journey.
And not to mention global warming.
Yes, it's a journey in doing your case. You learn more about the law. You develop confidence. It's therapeutic. And you have confidence and you can help others. So it can be very good. But you won't get that learning by using a lawyer, because they will sort of take over and charge you, and you won't get that learning experience. They won't teach you. I do it as a teacher.
You become your own lawyer.
You become your own lawyer.
Right.
But you've got to be careful at first. There's a lot of steps, and you can run into problems, things you didn't know about in court, and so on. So,
how many people are there in the room who still would like to ask questions of David? You do, one. Anybody else? Three. Okay, we'll start with you, Mark, if you may.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you about this. I do roofing work. I'm a self-employed man. I do my own jobs, and I have three people that have not paid me over the years. One is of an ethnic group, or two of them are of, let's say all three are of the ethnic group that is in the East Mediterranean, right? Let's just call it that. that their roots are in the eastern part of the Mediterranean.
How old are the debts? Within 6 years?
No, one is about 3 years, one is 1 year, and one is only a few months.
They're in time, then okay.
Right. So
I have sort of given up on those. I thought, well, as a good Christian boy, I will just allow them to have them. I cannot do anything else. I did that. I went on the website of the Department of Fair Trading, and I wrote exactly as they said there. This is the template. This is what you write. I wrote the first one. I wrote the second one. And then I didn't hear anything from them. And I don't know what to do next. The next
you want to meet up for coffee and we'll do the lean process. We'll do it on all three at once.
I'm scared of that. Oh, no. Right.
Okay.
Make them jump. Oh, and the worst that can happen, you get to own all their assets.
Right.
At law.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes, Jim.
Well, one of the case I mentioned before, what happens if you have that corruption in the court system at a high level?
If you're doing it yourself and you know your case and your matter, you'll pick up on that.
Yeah, which you know who knows.
And you can do that in. Well. Yeah, but I attended and I thought.
Yeah, you've been to one of his cases.
I thought he doesn't know how to do notice to admit facts.
No.
You do notice to admit facts and you lock in all the facts. The judge has got to go with the law.
Because the judge, they basically throw. They just. All the evidence we presented, not admissible. And they just allowed nothing in.
His matter was in the federal court. You can do a notice to admit facts. It's called notice to admit in the federal court. And we can work out one of those and shoot it off. They'll ignore it. And we say, you've admitted everything. You won, and now you've admitted everything. We suddenly won. According to the law.
There was some pretty damning evidence there, including there in Hansard, an admission, a flagrant admission. We can't have an admission in Hansard.
He's still in a position on the evidence to apply for a exemption on Fukuma, an exemption for Fukuma. Yes, any other questions?
This gentleman at the back, Robert.
Yes. Is there anyone wants to go?
No, go on, Robert.
I've got a question.
Well, just a second, yeah, Robert has the nod. Yes, take your...
I'll put a simple question to you. Do you believe the legal profession are crooks?
No, but you don't know what's going on with them. You get a feeling of illusion when you use them. You may win, you may lose, you don't know. You may not learn anything. I think it's better to learn and become much more powerful and stronger. And if there is corruption, you'll pick up on it and see it. And you'll be able to nip it in the bud and they know you know what you're doing. And I'm happy with the legal system. I love it. Because I understand
I'm
it now to do it.
I'm talking about the legal system. I'm talking about
lawyers. As long as they're on the other side, because if you know how to do it, you can use the lawyer on the other side to help you, and his client pays. So there's a way to do that. Yeah. So.
But that's not the answer to the question. Are they crooks?
Some.
I think
they mix with criminals. They work out how to get money out of criminals by getting something over them.
Okay. I think Bill's going to have the last word.
Have you read the less than 20 pages from the New South Wales Bar Association's guidelines for barristers on dealing with self-represented litigants? I had a browse through it, and it talks about the impact on the client. The client that is paying money to a barrister is this is for barristers saying your client could become upset because there's a self-represented litigant and they're not paying. Your client is paying, they're likely to get angry. So it's a thing about keeping them calm through the process. It talks about also being understanding that the judge, usually in New South Wales, is sympathetic to the self-representing litigant by giving them their time of day, plenty of it, explaining things to them. It talks about the judicial officer, who's like the administrator in the court, having to often help out, go out of his way to a person who's not a barrister. It talks about, this is interesting, when and do you negotiate with the other barrister? In that confidence can be used by you as evidence in the actual presentation in the court, which normally it wouldn't. If two barristers meet outside to discuss things, that is non-evidential or cannot be used up in court. So it warns barristers about that.
We want litigants in person to know what they're doing and not waste the court's time. There's no fun being up against a party who doesn't understand the matter, who doesn't understand what to do. We like litigants to know how to win, prepare, present and win. Not
I
to have
can't
to be
help
taught.
But ask the question, aren't you becoming that barrister? If you're versed, if you're so versed...
I am like that. I've been told I'm like a barrister, yes.
So
you really do sound like that.
I'll tell you a fun story in the garage case in many years ago in the district court. I was up against the barrister, Townsend was his name, and I felt quite confident with the case. The barrister Townsend sat about two-thirds back in the court, so I went and sat right next to him, and the judge noticed that I was sitting right next to the defendant's barrister, and he said, "You two are arguing each other's case." So I won that matter on conversion. I won that on conversion. But that was all very interesting. Sitting next to the barrister, sort of disconcerting.
Now, the law is made for us. We are not made for the law. The law is supposed to serve the people. But the law intimidates most people. It hasn't intimidated you.
I did initially, but I learned. I learned because I had to. I had to learn.
Well, the law has not intimidated you to the extent that you have the monkey by his balls, you know. And frankly, I think you're doing a grand job, because if you can keep the law in awe of the ordinary person who is not a lawyer and who is proud of not being a lawyer and tell people how they can beat the system. See, mostly the law in most countries, probably here too, but more so in certain other countries, is set up to intimidate and frighten people.
Yes.
And it is the instrument of a powerful clique of people who happen to own both assets and power. The two normally go together, but they don't have to. But if you can train people not only to fight their own cases in court, but to have no fear of the judiciary, which most people do have, then you have scored a noble victory, whether you win every case or not. And therefore, I found this evening's talk of yours, David, very interesting from the point of view of the fact that we've learned more about what is possible, what it is possible to do in a court. Most people are terrified of a court. They look upon the court as a sort of torture chamber,
yes.
which they have been invited into and which they may emerge from a complete or minus various parts of their anatomy. Therefore, I think if you can demythologize the law, if you can demythologize the law, there's one phrase which infuriates me, David, the majesty of the law. Now, I didn't invent that. The majesty of the law. The law is supposed to be majestic. All rise, the judge is here. And they all stand up, of course. That's right. The law, the majesty of the law. If we can diminish slightly the presumed majesty of the law, then we will be more like sovereign individuals, won't we? Therefore, thank David in the usual way.
Wow.
Well done. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. You've all got my phone number on that brochure. You need to ring up for any reason. And if you know anyone who's got awful, awful debts, well, let's have fun and do it. Let's do them. Wipe them out.
Great stuff. Thanks, David. Thanks for coming.
See, the wood ducks have got the guns. And we're fighting back.
Well done. Great.
Thank you very much.
Sorry to win more people.
If you want a copy of that, you can give me your email address. Oh, and I've got an internet marketing opportunity. If people want a good one, a good internet marketing opportunity, give me your email address and I'll send you something. Put it on this sheet of paper here.